Daddy, we're doing?
I'm doing a podcast, Dizzy. Hello and welcome to the Too Cool for School podcast. I am your host, Yannick. And on today's episode, I've got an amazing guest with me and we'll be speaking about his unique journey into higher education. So I'll allow them to introduce themselves and share a bit more about who they are.
Cool. Well, thanks for having me on, Yannick. My name is Sam. I'm 28. I'm from South London originally, living in East, but yeah, currently work at Clearview Research as a senior project executive, and I'm a graduate on the founding cohort of the London Interdisciplinary School. So yeah, thanks for having me on.
Okay, that's amazing. So you said you were part of the founding cohort of the London Interdisciplinary School. Can you tell us more about that sort of setting and what it was like to be a founder and what essentially was that establishment sort of like founded on?
Yeah, so that essentially is a startup university. It's really cool because we were the first students to ever graduate from that uni, the first students to ever do the course at that uni. So essentially, I heard about the uni in 2019 originally, and I just saw a YouTube video, and it was like quite cool, quite like some good marketing, and it was essentially a strap line that caught me. It said, "For those who want to shape the world and not just fit in." Wow. And essentially COVID delayed them for 1 year, so I was working in I was working with young people at the time actually, and then 2021 came back around and I remembered the uni and I was like, oh yeah, I wonder what they're up to. And I literally put my application in, and essentially being at that uni, it's like it is a tight-knit community. So you got your faculty, you got your staff, but bear in mind there was only 60 something of us on the first cohort, so
it's 60 students,
60 something wow, students. So it's so tight-knit, you know everyone's name. The faculty are so invested in you succeeding as a person. So it was like, yeah, it was an amazing experience.
That's amazing. Did you have any concerns, like it being a startup uni, thinking, are they going to have like lecture halls, seminar rooms? Would they even have like staff? Yeah. Like what concerns did you have early doors, if any, or did you just sort of move in with confidence saying, you know what, I'm just going to give this a try?
Yeah, no, it's a good question. You know, for me, I won't lie, I'm naturally a risk taker. So for me, it was exciting. I saw the adventure. Funny enough, I'd actually tried uni before. I went to Northampton University. I think I did about one term and I dropped out. And it was just that sense of like, nobody knows who I am here. I'm just another student. Obviously, I had like people there, a couple guys and that. But you know, you had your little bubble and that was it. The faculty didn't know your name, staff, that you were just another number. So for me, coming into this university, it was like, oh, okay, I'm an actual individual here that people recognize, understand. I'm like bought into this. And yeah, for me, it wasn't really scary or nerve wracking. If anything, I wanted the opposite of my experience at a big traditional university.
Yeah. And What did you study and what was your course about?
Bro, it's like every time I have to say the course name is so funny because it's Interdisciplinary Problems and Methods.
Okay, yeah, that sounds like a headache in itself.
Whenever I say that, you get that look like, okay, so what does that mean exactly?
Yeah.
So essentially, we focused on problems, complex problems. So whether that's our first term was around that wealth inequality, whether that's sustainability, looking at it from, you know, economics or a societal perspective, whether that's looking at the future of urban cities. So we look at problems, and then the interdisciplinary part is rather than focusing in or using the lens of one academic discipline, we combine multiple disciplines and essentially merge them together to have an interdisciplinary lens. Yeah. So rather than, I only study economics and that's how I see the world, it's like, okay, how do I combine an economic, a philosophical,
even a socialist design, approach,
even a scientific perspective on something. How do I combine these perspectives to hopefully give me a more holistic understanding about this issue I'm trying to tackle.
Yeah, that's so interesting. And when you get those different perspectives, do you sort of come up with one answer, or do you say these are the results that we've got from each individual perspective and they're all valid and we're going to use all of them, or do you combine it to create one?
100% the latter. So, you know, I think anyone who's tackled a complex problem or who's thought about a complex problem, there's, if there was one answer, everybody would do it, right?
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
But that's kind of the limited thinking they wanted us to hopefully grow out of, that actually to a complex problem, you're never just going to have, oh, this is the answer, right? It's going to be, okay, let's take a bit of this perspective, let's take a bit of that perspective, and let's hopefully move forward in a direction based on all these things we kind of know, whilst also remembering that we probably don't have the full picture either.
Yeah.
So it's funny because it just kind of like twists up your mind even more, but in a good way.
But it's good. It's good to consider, you know, all the perspectives, because what you then end up doing is, if you're chasing one answer and you can't get the one answer, you're going to have headache anyway.
100%,
so give me something, you know. Could you... If you don't mind, before we move on, could you share a bit about why going to uni at the time that you did, when you said you went to Nottingham and you did a term there? Could you share why you felt that didn't work for you? Was it around like the education? Was it moving away from you know, London? Was it, you know, the wrong course? Because, you know, we know people that go to uni, they do a course after a term, they feel like, actually, do you know what, this ain't the course for me, or this ain't the place for me. So could you share a bit about the decision behind that? And was it an easy decision to say, do you know what, I'm not going to, you know, to stick around? Because I know, you know, in terms of our community and our background, deciding to go to uni and then deciding to drop out is not going to be taken, you know, lightly at home. So
No, good question. So it was Northampton.
Okay, Northampton. Yeah,
Northampton. And bro, if I'm just being honest, real, when I went to uni, I wasn't really there to learn.
Yeah,
I was still active, like on the roads and stuff. So I was basically there to kind of hustle.
Yeah,
so
for
going
sure.
to uni was kind of the, okay, mom, this is what I'm doing with my life, but, you know, one foot in the game, essentially trying to hustle, trying to, you know, trying to get it, essentially.
Yeah, of course, of course.
So when I got there, there wasn't nothing that even drew me into education in any type of form. It was just like, I'm out there living with a couple of my guys and I'm just trying to hustle.
No, that's interesting. That's interesting. So then coming back to London and going to the London Interdisciplinary School.
LIS, we just call it.
LIS, yeah, let's just say LIS. Like, how old were you then when you started?
LIS, I was 24 when I started LIS.
24?
Yeah, yeah.
Were there other cohorts who were starting uni at the sort of normal uni age, from like sixth form and college? And if so, how did you... We say mature student because that's, you know, that's like the correct term, even though you wouldn't have been like an old man like on campus. But how was it like being a mature student with all the other like 18, 19 year olds that were on campus?
Yeah,
as well?
No, it was good. The good thing about my cohort, there was definitely a mix.
Okay,
so
that's
I was
positive.
One of the older statesmen.
Yeah, uncle.
Yeah, definitely uncle on campus, bro. But it was funny because, like, let's say I'm 24, I got along with a few like 19-year-olds, 21-year-olds. So they're not like mad young, but there is definitely an experience gap, especially what I said, I've like, you know, I was involved in other stuff before. So definitely an experience gap, but there was also some people similar to my age. But yeah, definitely, I think at first those thoughts maybe came to mind like, oh, I'm kind of old here or whatever, but again, the environment, the open-mindedness of the place, I never felt, yeah, no one made me feel like that. That's probably just in my head, a little bit of imposter syndrome or whatever, but it was, yeah, it was all right. It wasn't a big issue at all, really, yeah.
And what were your thoughts on, like, even before uni, like, what were your thoughts on education? Like, how did you find education growing up, like whether it was like secondary school or whether you went to like college, was it a thing that you was like engaged in, or was it like you were saying before, like sort of one foot in, one foot out, and trying to sort of balance that?
Yeah, so I like came from a Nigerian household, so there was no option but to to pattern the school books. Yeah. So through primary school, secondary school, I was always did what I needed to do in school, and I got the grades. And a lot of that, you know, obviously God bless my parents, and that, like, you know, they instilled the like get your education, do what you need to do. So I didn't really have a choice of not doing well enough. So I always managed to do well enough, and I also didn't find it quite difficult, if I'm being honest. At that young age, it wasn't super difficult for me. So, like, you know, left GCSEs with like 9 A-to-C's, and that was like me not even trying.
Yeah, for like, sure.
Just taking a piss in school, really. Yeah. And then when I went to sixth form now, I was already like in school, I was already like kind of dabbling with certain things. As I said, I wasn't trying, so I was like, you know, doing little bits and bobs, hustles, but nothing like too intense.
Yeah.
And when I went to sixth form, I didn't get into my secondary school sixth form. And I actually look back and I'm like, I think that made a big difference on me. I probably didn't know it at the time, but I think it actually hurt me. And like, I was just like, you know what, like school's not really for me. I went to college, just messing around and just, you know, kind of.
When you say hurt you, is that more like emotionally or hurt you in terms of the long-term impact of like your life and the repercussions?
A bit of both, you know.
Yeah.
Like, I'll say emotionally, because again, I'm young, so I don't really have the emotional intelligence. But it's like, oh, rah, like, I applied to my school and they didn't even let me in. Teachers liked me, all of this stuff. So in my head, I'm thinking like, loud, okay, man, all of these. And then on the other side, the long-term repercussions was, I think I just had too much freedom at that age.
Yeah.
And that kind of allowed me to go wild with my own plans for life. Whereas I think I know that all my guys that stayed in sixth form, they had to dress up, like wear suits or smart clothing. Whereas I went to a college, SFX.
Yeah.
It was just about like looking good.
Yeah.
No one cares if you don't come class or not.
Yeah, for sure.
So yeah, it was just a different environment. It was too much freedom for me at that age, basically, I'll be honest.
Now that's interesting, man. And I feel, like, even giving your example of sixth form, I went to my school sixth form, but I didn't apply. But I remember, like, the school just saying,
yeah, like, let him go. Just come
September, like, you'll be here. Like, you don't need to apply. Because, and I've said this in previous, you know, podcasts, that academically, like, there was no issues. I was a bright student, but behaviour-wise. But I think at that point, they start to see the transition. They start to notice when people come to sixth form, like, you're not getting into the same type of like behavioral issues that you would see in secondary school. And I'm sort of reflecting, and I understand where you're coming from, because if I didn't go to my sixth form and I went to another sixth form or college with teachers that don't know my temperament, that don't know, you know, like my character, that would have been like a difficult transition for me. And I remember as well, at the time, my family had moved from East London to South London. So my little brothers and sisters went to secondary school in Southwest London. And I remember having the option of going to or looking for sixth forms.
Okay.
In South London, but I just opted to travel. I was like, you know what, I can't be arts. It's just 2 years. I'm just going to travel back. You know, I'm just going to travel back and forth. But I think that definitely has an impact. And I wonder as well if there are other people who have been in similar situations where it's like they haven't got into their sixth forms of their respective schools, and how they feel about that emotionally in terms of what that does in relation to like a sense of belonging. Like, I've been here 5 years, like, I know you guys, and you don't even want me here.
It's a bit of rejection.
That's rejection, isn't it? That's crazy.
It's funny how you spoke about that journey of going from southwest to east. Like, was it southwest or just south?
From east to southwest.
East to southwest. And you say you was living in southwest and you was going to sixth form in east.
Yeah.
Like, just that journey, that separation from maybe just being a local guy, like you actually have a journey to go on. So you got time, like you ain't necessarily got as much time on your hands. I think it makes, like, just a young guy in it, as you said, little temperament things, it just keeps you occupied a little bit more. As you said, you've got that wraparound of teachers that know you. They're like, okay, cool, Yannick, like, we know something move like this, but we want the best for you, so
100.
Let's help to, you know, help manage you at this age. And I think it makes a big difference, really, from my perspective. So.
Yeah, no, 100%. And I know, I remember when I was reading online, and I was reading, like, your blog, there was a few books that you were reading and were recommending people to read. I think I noted one of the book, I can't remember, was it How to Outwit the Devil?
Oh, yeah, Outwitting the Devil.
Outwitting the Devil. And I was like, oh, cool, yeah. That's on my to-do list, like, to, you know, to purchase as I'm in that, you know, that sort of, like, reading phase again. And I wanted to ask, like, your sort of, like, love or keenness, like, to read. Is that something that sort of came later on in life? Have you always been interested in, like, reading and self-learning, or where did that sort of start for you?
I'll say there was two points in my life that I know I was really on it with reading, except for now, because I still read. But when I was really young, I used to read, and it was funny because I bumped into my football coach. I bumped into him at church, actually, funny enough. We didn't plan, we just bumped into each other, and he was telling, like, my wife about how I was as a young guy. And he's like, yeah, you know, we used to call him Doctor because we'll be on the bus to football, this guy will be reading big books. And I was like, oh yeah, like, I did used to love reading. So that was, like, something that actually happened quite recently. And then the other point in my life where my passion for reading was igniting was I was in prison at the time. And I just, I remember that book specifically, Outwitting the Devil.
Yeah.
Just reading that, and just kind of almost feeling like a light bulb moment. It was just such a great book. Essentially, it's about a man who is having this, like, I don't know, like, vision or experience with the devil, essentially. And he's asking him questions like, how do you trick humanity? Like, how do you implement your tactics on humanity? And he just, I don't want to spoil the book, but it's so good, because whether you believe in a devil or not, it's just about, you can notice some of the behaviors and traits that the devil's mentioning to this guy about how he kind of veers people off from maybe living a life of purpose.
Obviously,
I'm in jail at the time, and I'm just thinking, damn, maybe some of these things has kind
the devil
happened.
Got me.
He got me still.
Yeah.
Like, it's, yeah, you know, it's one of those things, like, raw, like, all of these decisions I've made, was that really me, or was like, have my path been kind of shaped, like, veered off a bit? So yeah, that was that one, a big book that really kind of influenced me at the time.
Yeah. And you mentioned as well, like, spending like, some time inside, like, how was you able to find the sort of motivation to say to yourself, do you know what, I'm going to pick up a book, I'm going to read, or I'm going to look at opportunities to educate myself, or look at opportunities to study and, you know, prepare myself so when I come out, I can, you know, sort of make a difference in my life? And the reason I ask that is because there's many people that go through experiences that we have, you know, experienced, or that you have experienced, and often, you know, if you don't have the right mentality, you can get stuck in that box of saying, do you know what, like, this, you know, this is me, and I can't come out of that. And you know, and I use my own experience, like, as a testimony, and I always, you know, say this with transparency, because I know there's people online that you know, maybe watching the content or know me from back then and be like, oh, let me keep an eye on him and make sure you don't, because you know how, but it's, we know how you were. And, you know, one of the things that I used to always be like conscious of is like applying for jobs and, you know, having to like disclose like my criminal record and whatever else. And I used to feel that that was a taint on me and my character, even though I've sort of gone, you know, past that and I've pushed on. But obviously I never got to the position of being, you know, incarcerated in prison. So, like, in that environment, how was you still able to build that sense of motivation to say, do you know what, I'm going to learn, I'm going to push, and I'm not going to allow this experience to taint, you know, the plan that I've got for myself moving forward?
Yeah, no, definitely. I think, you know, ultimately for me, I give all the glory to God, and I believe that, you know, he's always going to, he's got his hand over your life and he's looking after you even when you go off the path. So for me, I think I probably saw, no, actually I remember, I went to education one day.
Mm-hmm.
And there was a lady up there who was just cool, like a black woman. I think she was from Sierra Leone. And
big girl up.
Yeah, literally. Mm-hmm. And she was just, I think she had an affinity with like the young black guys in there, like, you know, young black boy. I was like 18 when I went in, 19. Mm-hmm. And she just kind of looked at me and she was like, do you read? And I was like, oh no, miss, I'm not on all of that. And she was like, no, there's this really good book called Rich Dad Poor Dad. Mm-hmm. And that was the first book I read in prison. Like, let's say I read that when I was 18 or 19. I hadn't read since I left school. Like, and I'm even mean like A-levels, I didn't even really read. Like, mm-hmm. as I said, I was just messing around. So genuinely, since I had left secondary school, that was the first book I sat down and read. And I remember reading it and just getting alive, like, okay, to read more.
Mm.
And from then it just became like a, rather than like asking my family to send me in clothes and stuff, I'd be like, oh, can you get me this book? Can you get me that book? And I just was like known as one of the guys with like a stack of books in my cell. Like, anytime I'm moving around, I got a big bag of books. It almost became like my currency. Like, I enjoyed it. I like people coming to see, oh, my book stack and that. So, yeah, essentially, I think reading that book, again, it's like part of education. You just open your mind and you realize that, okay, there's a possibility greater than where I am now. And I believe that this isn't the end of my story. Like, there's way more to come. Obviously, there's the pulls and there's the lures of like wanting to stay on the path I am. But when you kind of see yourself bigger than your situation, see yourself bigger than where you are right now, you're like, okay, there's more to push towards. I am here right now and it is what it is, and I come from this background, but in my heart I see myself more than what I am now. Like, you might not see it, but I see it. Even to this day, I still feel like I'm not even nowhere near where I want to be, because I see myself
as
way more than where I am. That's right. Amazing. Now, so
yeah. And how does the prison system overall view education? So obviously, you know, you've got the woman that you spoke about from Sierra Leone who, you know, was very intentional with, you know, thinking about how do I engage these young black boys? How do I get them to read and to enjoy reading? But as a whole, how is the prison system, like, how do they view education? Is that something that's encouraged? Like, okay, go do education, or is it optional, or how does it work?
So there's, prison's interesting because there's a lot of people with a low literacy level in there, like, you know, grown men who can't read, people who, obviously, as I said, I came from a Nigerian background, so you had to, education wasn't an option, but, you know, there's certain families where it's not that deep. Some people left school at 13 and their parents weren't forcing them. So there's really low levels of education in prison. So getting grown men back interested in education is a tough ask. And I just don't think the prison system is equipped enough. They play like a lip service to education, but I don't think they really understand the power of, like, if you educate someone, they can really go on to make a difference. Certain people are sitting down for long sentences, and there should be more of an opportunity from them to start off. Like, some people literally have to start off with, like, level ones, like level one English and maths, and then they need to go to level two. So level two is, like, yeah, like your GCSEs and stuff. So there's, like, really low levels, and I think that, yeah, there's a basic service in place, but is it inspirational? Is it aspirational? It's not. So, okay, you got to do your level. They will say, oh, you got to do your level one and level two if you want to get this job in the prison or that job in the prison. But, okay, if I don't want a job, then what are you going to do? I'm not going to, you know what I mean?
Yeah,
so,
yeah.
Whereas as, like, creating more of an aspirational pull to it, they kind of use it almost as a, like, beat, like a stick approach rather than a carrot. And actually, that's one of the reasons why I actually do some work with a company called DWRM. And we go into prisons and we essentially provide opportunities for, like, further and higher education through our university and course providers. We essentially repackage some of the material and make it accessible for guys in prisons, because obviously they can't be online, innit? So
yeah,
we make it accessible, and it's a great thing, because I get to go and share my story. The guy I work with, Dan, he done a long time, like a life sentence basically, and he's come out, and he went from literally one of those guys, level one, left school at 13, to he's finishing off his PhD now.
Right.
And it's just like,
big up Dan as well.
Big up Dan. And it's like, there's way more people that could, who have that potential, but it's not because the prison, he did that despite the prison system instead of, like, oh, because of the prison system. So there's definitely a lot of room for the prison system. And obviously prison systems are big, for certain prisons are better than others, right? But in general, I'd say it's not like a big push on, like, oh, we want you to be educated and this is the power of education. Do you know what I mean? It's like, oh, do your education or you can't do that or whatever.
Yeah. No, that's so interesting. And with the low level of, like, literacy, is it that, are we saying that because they've been in prison, like, from a young age, they haven't learned? Are we saying that they're even coming in with low literacy levels?
Yeah.
Or is it a combination?
Yeah,
above?
Combination, because if you even look at, let's say, the what do they call it, like, PRU to prison pipeline, like, someone gets kicked out of school at, I don't know, like, year 8, like, maybe even use yourself an example. I don't know what you was like in year 9 or year 10, where you just a little, you know what I mean, on whatever. Imagine you get kicked out of school, then okay, now you're in a PRU, you're amongst other kids from your area who aren't really on education,
in and out of the youth justice system,
Now you've done a bigger crime, you go to prison. So actually, when did you really learn how to read properly? When did you really learn how to develop your critical thinking? So now you're in prison, you actually still have the education of someone who's, like, in year 8 or year 7, really, and you're now, like, 18, 19, 20, like, you're a grown man, but you still have that level of education. And then let's say you've got a long sentence to go, maybe you're 25, maybe you're 30 years old, and you still have, like, you actually haven't developed your ability to learn, your literacy level. So it's definitely, I would say most people come into prison with that low level, and they just haven't had the opportunity, because either they came in, like, at a young age, or they were just on the roads when they were outside. Like, they weren't really on going to school like that anyway. So doesn't necessarily mean they needed to be in, but they just wasn't, education in that way just wasn't working for them anyway. So they've kind of just stayed on that trajectory.
And in terms of the personnel that support with the education, like, what's the competency of, like, the staff? Do they have, like, teachers? Do they have people who, like, specialize in, like, ADHD, autism, learning difficulties? Like for example, the woman who encouraged you to, read the book. Like, what was her role? And what's, like, the general competency of the staff who are supporting with education?
Yeah, so, like, prison education is contracted out to different providers. So yeah, there's, like, Milton Keynes College, there's a company called Novus, there's different stuff, right? And these companies provide education to specific prisons. So they will provide the level one, the level two, level three courses. And there are great people in there, don't get me wrong, but they're working in a tough environment. Like, the people who come in to do the education type jobs are like, they've come from that teaching backgrounds, education backgrounds, but then you've come into this, like, I won't lie, like a little bit of an oppressive system. So you might, it's like the new teacher who comes into a bad school. Yeah, like, oh, they're all bubbly, just come off the graduate scheme. And they're like, bro, like no one even cares in here. The kids are moving mad. And over time, I think that definitely wears you out. That optimism, that hope kind of gets pulled out of you a little bit. And I don't think any of those, like, as I said, people working in education came in there with any bad intention. Of course not. Why would you, like, if you was working in a school, why would you come into prison just to be a bad person? You probably just have been worn down over time by the system. So, yeah, they do have, like, levels of competency there, but do they get that ability to be inspiring and provide hope and, like, you know, really be a great teacher? I think it's quite difficult because you're also working with men who don't like education. That's the truth. You know, they're maybe being kicked out of school, as you said, maybe they've got learning difficulties. A lot of don't know my stats, but a high proportion of men in prison have some sort of neurodivergence, and I believe they're actually bringing in a role within each prison to help with that, like a head of neurodivergence or something like that, because you'll see it, like, if you go in now, like, if you're aware of that, you go into prison, you see how people are moving in there, you're like, okay, it makes sense, you probably got ADHD. You was kicked out of school when you was like 11. Why did you get kicked out? Oh, because I was doing this. Yeah, you probably do have ADHD, but never been diagnosed. Maybe even have, like, you're on the autism spectrum, so you can't even, like, possibly interact socially in a way that's socially acceptable, right? So now people look at you a certain way. Oh, and so there's so many, so many compounding issues, really.
And when you were inside, did you have others, or did you meet other, like, prisoners who also had the same academic or educational aspirations as you? Because, like you said, a lot of people are in their different learning abilities, and sometimes to be able to inspire and aspire is very difficult. So it will be interesting to know whether you found, like, a community, or even if it was just like one person who shared that inspiration or shared that passion, or found the value in learning, in education, etc.
Yeah, I had one of my good friends on the wing, who was definitely on the reading thing with me. So we would always have, like, loads of books, swap books. Yeah,
the book club.
Yeah, the book club, basically. It's like, oh, you read this one, you read that one. And then there's a few guys that would go up to, like, different education, like different education workshops or classes. But I don't think whilst I was in there, I was super like, oh yeah, I'm gonna like go to uni and I was more so like just trying to better myself. So there was a few people who were like studying and that, but I don't know if I'll necessarily say they inspired me like that, to be honest.
I know you mentioned before, like, you highlighted some of the barriers for you know, prisoners accessing education. So around, like, their learning needs, around the sort of engagement and the competency of, you know, certain levels, you know, of staff as well, and things of that nature. I'll be interested to know as well, like, do you think like in prison, like, the system considers, like, education as a tool for, like, rehabilitation? Do you think they see it as that, and do you think it can be used as a tool for rehabilitation?
I'll be honest, I don't think they do. Again, part of that work I do with DWRM, like, you know, where essentially
sure, what is DWRM?
I was doing what really matters.
Yeah,
it's a great company. Yeah, people check it out. But yeah, like, that's essentially part of the work we're doing, is like advocating, showing, like, you know, education is a tool. Like when you help someone learn, you help them develop critical thinking skills, you help to radically reduce their chances of reoffending. And again, stats are out there, you know, like even within our cohort of people that we've worked with through DWRM, like majority of them do not go back to prison because they've now got hopes, they've now got plans, they've now got, even if it is they want to go uni or they're doing, like, because we help them maybe start a uni course, they come out, they've got a focus, oh no, no, I need to finish my degree, like, you know what I mean, you've got a focus. And I don't think the prison system really understands what are some of the key levers that help people to reduce reoffending. They have these weird ideas and they come up with these weird plans, but if you really speak to people who have come out of prison and have managed to not go back to prison and they're, let's say, finding some level of like fulfillment in their day-to-day life, you'll realize like, yeah, probably like education, meaningful work, family, you know, relationships, you know, just the key tenets of a good life, essentially. But it's like, how do you encourage, how do you set people up to like really utilize those things? So like, for example, there's a rule in the prison system, and I think it's student finance actually, that so let's say someone's got a long-term sentence, let's say you got 10 or 12 years to do behind the door, innit? You have to serve 12 years. You can only apply for student finance when you've got about 6 years left. So that means half of your sentence, you ain't really got much to do. Then the last, so by the time you've come to that 6 years, you might not even be on it anymore. You might not even care. Like, rather than like, okay, you start your prison sentence, here's the roadmap for you to go from, like my friend Dan, from, because he was in back before, so I think he might not have needed student finance or something. But like for someone who's in now, how do you go from like, yeah, level ones, not knowing anything, to maybe completing a master's? Like that's probably something they would have not done when they were outside because they would have been too busy with their life. So when you really think about how education can be a good structure to help people begin to start making meaningful progress, you could like really use it as some sort of tool. But again, I just don't think, you know, everyone, like, if I'm being honest, it's all about money, isn't it? Like,
no, that's my brain is fried out. I was listening, I was thinking, wait, so even in prison, guys are applying for like student loans, that's like, I didn't know this.
Definitely.
Didn't know this.
Because you can study through, like DWRM, we're a company that you can access higher education, but there's also the Open University. So a lot of people, I think people use the Open University on the outside as well.
Yeah.
But yeah, a few guys study through the Open Uni as well.
No, that's interesting. That's very interesting. Thank you for sharing that. I didn't know much about that, and it's definitely something I'm going to sort of look into a bit more and really just understand the logistics around that. I wanted to ask as well, so you know, you made a lot of progress since leaving prison. You've been involved in, you know, some amazing projects. Do you ever have any sort of fears or anxieties around how you might be perceived or how people might perceive your background when you step into, you know, these rooms, these circles where you're having, you know, sort of, you know, major influence in these spaces? Do you ever feel that your past or background sort of gives you a sense of like fear or anxiety of how you might be perceived?
It's funny because I feel like for a long time I shied away from my past. I wanted to kind of remove myself from it. Like, okay, I've come out, I've changed my life. I'm, you know, creating a new identity, essentially, which I think in some part is very true. But there's a part of actually I'm building on who I am. I can't ever change who I was. You know what I mean? That's part of what's got me here today. So instead of seeing it as like building on it, I think I was really trying to like separate myself from it. And I wouldn't necessarily say I was like ashamed or anything, but I wanted people to respect me for who I was today, like respect me for my competency, respect me for my ability to execute all of these things. And for me, I felt like, oh, if they know I've been to prison, they might like, oh, think this about me or that about me. But I also learned that it's part of my story, you know, how I got here today is I went through that path to get where I am today. So I don't try to like not bring it up, but you know, like when you ask me a question like, yeah, oh, when did like reading become a big, I can't, yeah, not but talk, yeah, yeah, about that, innit?
Because it's, well, part of the journey.
It's,
yeah,
part of the journey. So I don't ever feel like ashamed of it. But I think there was a point where I was trying to like separate it, or maybe just, yeah, like, oh, this is me who, mm-hmm, I am now. That, but now, nowadays I'm getting better at like articulating. It's part of the journey. If it comes up, yeah, it's good. But also, it also gives me a perspective on life that's unique. As you said, it's a unique, yeah, journey. It's my journey. So
yeah, that's important. And I think you use a good analogy, to not separating it, but building on it. And I think that's something I can say that I tried to do as well. Like trying to separate it, you know, like every employer, oh, do you have a, you know, blah, blah, blah. Okay, you're going to have to like disclose it. So we need to know,
yeah, yeah,
about what happened. So it's not like, oh, I can just say to them, just read the DBS. You're going to see it anyway. But they, yeah, want the details. I don't know why. They've they've always wanted the details, which I always find weird. But like you said, I like 100% agree. Like this is part of the journey, but it's part of the blocks. Like this was just an add-on to what's come, you know, what's come, or what, you know, people are seeing now. So we shouldn't shy away from that. And it does offer us a unique perspective. And that's why, especially when I think about like the platform that, you know, I have now and the platform that I'm creating now, in that, you know, I consider myself an education specialist, because I've got my experience of being and studying in education. I've got my experience of working in education in different levels, whether that's head of year, governance, or whatever else. But then I've also got that unique perspective of, whilst I was in education, I was also engaging with the youth criminal justice system. I'm also a young black boy that was suspended and excluded from school or whatever.
Yeah, yeah.
So I've got unique perspectives around education that no one else has.
Yeah.
So when, you know, when we was having a conversation, you know, just before this, and you was talking about like the project that you're working on and the importance of us being, you know, around those tables, that's why you need people like me around the table.
100%.
Because I'm sorry, but the old white man that's been a head teacher for 40, 50 years and has X amount of students who are from a demographic that he's not aware of, and they're just being excluded or whatever, he's not going to know more about education or more about their needs than I would. And it's not saying that his experience is not valid, because 40 years ahead as a head teacher is amazing. Oh, but it's actually, let's get people around the table who's going to help me 100%. Understand the context in which we're currently living in, the context in which there's a school to prison pipeline, the context in which there's a greater number of, you know, students who are being excluded, you know, from certain demographics. And I think, you know, these conversations are definitely important. And I wanted to ask as well, what do you think is like the biggest like misconception or misunderstanding that society has about people who like have like criminal records or have a criminal past and are trying to like pave away from themselves, whether it's within education or as entrepreneurs or, you know, whatever else. Like, what do you think's the biggest misconceptions or biggest misunderstandings that society has?
Yeah, no, that's a great question. I think it's that people assume that people who get caught up in criminal justice system or people who, yeah, go to prison or whatever, that fundamentally they're bad people. That's why they made those decisions. But rightly, as you just articulated so like so great, is that if you haven't walked in those shoes or if you haven't come from certain areas, you will never understand that for some people crime is an easier path than being a legitimate law-abiding citizen. For some people it's actually like it's easier for them to go on that. So for them to not do the crime and that, that's a harder, more difficult path that they have to basically decide at a very young age. Whereas if you're a person who's grown up in an environment where there's, you know, the traditional nuclear family, everybody's working professionals, middle class, or even working class, but like working professionals, majority of your people in your area work and, you know, things go on relatively smoothly. You was in an environment that your default was to go down that path. So you never actually had to make a difficult decision. So it's easy to look at, for you to look at a person who at 18 has done a madness and, you know, yeah, ended up in jail for life. It's easy for you to look at it, they're so terrible. It's like, you don't know that that kid from like 12 years old, he's had to roll with something because, you know, this happened in school and then it's like, I think people really don't take into account that is this, I don't think it's conceptual, but, you know, the whole understanding of like adverse childhood experiences, like a lot of things happen to some people at a very young age that almost sets them up on this spiral that is so difficult to break out of. And I think when you look at a human and you look at a man that's been in and out of prison and is trying to like maybe make a difference or is trying to change his life, understand the journey he's had to take, understand that, you know, the demons he's had to fight to kind of change his life around. And I think that, you know, a lot of us, I'll say society needs probably mostly like the rhetoric and the media and politicians and all these things, like have an understanding and a grace for people who are different from you. Because if you was in their shoes, you probably would have made the same decision. That's the honest truth. Yeah, it's easy for you to look at them and cast a judgment or cast a perspective that, oh, they must be bad people or this or that. But trust me.
People just look at the end result. They just look at the crime and don't really bother to look at the sort of wider context. And you know, you made a good point about, you know, talking about the adverse, you know, childhood experience and that impacts so many children, you know, so many children who go through like even like traumatic experience. And I think one thing that sort of stands out for me in addition to that is the importance of representation within, you know, spaces of work. And beyond the football and the music, which our community, you know, could connect with, but even, you know, in spaces like finance, banking, in the creative industry, in law firms and whatever else, we need more representation like that. Because when you were talking about the environments that we've grown up with, I can tell you who had the best car on ends. I can tell you who had the best drip on ends. Because we used to see it and that's who we would, you know, aspire to, but we weren't seeing people like us coming back from their law job. This is the lawyer, you know, we've got the lawyer on. Because what often happens is the lawyers are the people that make it. They're like, yo, I need to get out of here.
I
need to get out of here because the ends is... And there's nothing wrong with that, but being intentional for the youth, whether that's in school or on TV, for them to see the positive representation of, you know, black adults and say, you know what, that's who I want to, you know, aspire to be. Because otherwise, you're going to aspire to be like the person from the ends. And it's interesting because another reflection that's coming up is we used to have this, you know, thing where this is all around London. This is not even an East thing, where there was a younger. You had the older, you had the younger.
Yeah.
Because you was aspiring to, you know, be like that person. So that's just, that's just an interesting
And you know, it's so funny, like, when you think about, like, the younger, older relationship, it's basically your mentor, you know, like, which is so mad. I never even did that. It's, like, literally your mentor.
Yeah.
And it's like, what if those same, like, youths had actual mentors, like, as you said, what if they had someone like a you, someone like myself, who's like, actually, I wouldn't
us now,
us now, literally, like, mentoring them. So powerful, so
100%. And just to finish off, it would be good to know, like, what's the future plan for Sam? Like, what does the future look like? I know you're doing some amazing projects, which we spoke about earlier, and you're doing some amazing work with DWRM
as well.
And Clearview Research as well. But what does, you know, what does the future hold? And I say that to say that this has been an amazing episode, because there's many people who are going to connect with this and say, you know what, I've got a lifeline. Like, I've listened to this, and these boys have shown me a lifeline, and it will be good to hear, not only for our audience, but in general, to see that actually that there is no ceiling in terms of, you know, our purpose and how we move, you know, forward. So it'll be good to hear, like, what you know, in any future plans are for yourself.
You know what, like, I'm a very ambitious person, so I've got, like, grand dreams and ambitions, even things like me and my wife want to develop, one of them being, like, we envision a house on a hill, a house in nature, which we invite people who need that space of restoration and rehabilitation, probably people from different, like, you know, ethnic minority communities, people who just wouldn't be able to access the healing that comes from being out of the ends and being somewhere out in the sticks, and you're just in a big house and you can just walk around and be free. That's something that's so deep and close to my heart. And I also see it tying in with probably some sort of, like, criminal justice, that whole concept of, like, you send people away to prison and you put them in a confinement. But even what I learned from being at LIS, like, prisons are sometimes a design problem. It's just not designed in a way that encourages people to rehabilitate. So what if this so-called prison, this house of restoration, was out in nature and was designed in a way that allows people to come out of a fight or flight, come out of anxiety, and allows them to relax, and maybe they might be more receptive to certain things. So that's one of, like, my big future visions that is close to my heart. And, you know, one day I'll be back here talking about what we're doing.
That's amazing, man. We'll hold you to that, man. And that will be your testimony for sure. And you know what? Like, when you was talking about that house on the hill and the peace that it gives, it reminded me of, I remember I did a summer, I was working on a summer program as like a program leader. This was years ago. and there was a boy on the program. He was active in it. He was just active. I don't even... But he was connected with, like, a youth offending service. And I think part of my role at the time was basically trying to get the young people that were on the youth offending service, I think it was, like, Southwark or Lambeth, to come on a program, you know, like a week on uni campus, you cook for yourself and you do all of that stuff. A week away, like camping.
Was it the Wales. Challenge?
The challenge, yeah, yeah, yeah.
I did that, you know.
Yeah, old school. Yeah. How old are you?
I'm 28.
I'm 35 this year.
Okay, yeah, you might have been a mentor.
But I might have been your mentor, you know, I don't even know. Yeah.
Yeah.
So we did that and the boy, he was active. And I remember we went to Wales. And I'm like, we were hiking. Because you know they do like the hike. Yeah. So we're hiking, we got to the mountain, like to the top of like the mountain, whatever. And I was just looking at him and I said, like you cool because you've been like crazy quiet. I was like, this is so peaceful.
Damn.
Yeah. I said, what do you mean? He was like, can you hear that? And I was like, no, like what's going on? He said, there's no sirens. That's
crazy.
He said, there's no sirens, there's no noise. And plus, I ain't got reception.
Yeah.
Like, so he's like, no, like my phone ain't.
Because
the whole time his phone would be going off. But, and he's just like, oh, put phone back. And in that moment, I was like, wow, they don't even come at the end to go anywhere where like there's nature and there's just peace. So, you know, like I'm praying for you and I hope that, you know, you and your wife will be able to do that and bring peace to you know, the people that need it. But Sam, thank you again for coming on. This was a great episode, very insightful. And you know, I really appreciate that and you know, I have your details on the socials for, you know, whoever wants to like connect with you professionally after this as well. But thank you, everyone, for listening to this episode. This has been the Too Cool For School podcast. If you enjoyed this episode, follow us on our social media pages and subscribe to our YouTube channel. Thank you.